Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to and hopefully enjoy. So not a lot of news this time out. I'm on a ship at sea, I'm crossing the Atlantic, I've got 5 days at sea now and not a lot to do except look out my window at the blue sky and the blue sea just going past. So I thought, well, I'll catch up on all of the podcasts that I didn't record while I was traveling through Africa on vacation with me and my girlfriend. We headed off, I stopped podcasting in that time, but I didn't stop reading. So I've got quite a few books to catch up on. And the book that I'm going to talk about today, I'm not going to be reviewing them in the same order that I read them. I just thought I'd review them as I got to them in my brain, if you know what I mean, as I was thinking about them. So I thought I would talk about Zoo City by Lauren Bucus. And it's a book which came out in, I think, 2010 or 2011. Oh, no, it says here published 2010, April 29th, 2010. It says 384 pages. I listened to it as an audiobook. It was around about, 12 hours on an audiobook, which is a really, really great length for a book, in my opinion. Of course, there's bigger books that you can read, smaller books. I've just bought a book by Brandon Sanderson, and it's called The Way of Kings, and this is, 1,258 pages. So nothing like that, a lot brisker read. And the book itself is set in Johannesburg in South Africa, and as I was traveling around Africa, I knew that the last stop on our journey, on our trip, was going to be in Johannesburg in South Africa, so I thought, well, I will time my listening to this audiobook as, you know, for when we're actually going to be traveling through the city. And that worked out really well. Of course, I'll talk about that in a little bit more. So I wanted to read this book for various reasons. I read some good reviews about it or heard about it and heard an interview with the author. And it sounded quite interesting. It's kind of an urban fantasy book set in Johannesburg with magic and animals. The setting is our world, which is quite refreshing, because I don't read a lot of urban fantasy, so to have just the world set up as it is now is pretty good. Set in, I guess, around about, 2010 or 2011, so very, very up to date, and the world is pretty much exactly as it is for us now, except something that's come about called the Zoo Plague. And the Zoo Plague, it's not really explained why this happened or how it happened or anything like that, but if you are guilty of a crime like murder or something like some very big crime, something that you can get very, very guilty about, you magically get assigned by magical powers outside the understanding of anyone. You get assigned an animal familiar and also a small magic power. And obviously you look very guilty if suddenly you have an animal with you all the time, so normally you get put in jail as well. And this animal can be any animal, lots and lots of different animals are mentioned in the book. You can get a dog, or a cat, or a bird, or a spider, or a sloth, or a bear, or a penguin, or anything like that. And if you and if something happens to you, your animal dies, but then the reverse is true as well. So if your animal is taken away from you, you get all these different pains and headaches and everything that's very uncomfortable, so you can never be separated from your animal. But also, if your animal dies or your animal is killed, a very strange thing called the undertow happens, which is very, very spooky, and the shadows around you come alive and drag you down into hell or make you disappear. I'm not quite sure exactly. Again, it's very, very mysterious. Not a lot of this is explained very much. I'll get more into the magic of this later on, but of course, different areas around the world have reacted to this new phenomenon, because it's only came around, 2004, 2005 was when it actually happened on a wide scale. Isolated events, records of it happened earlier on from around about 95 or something like that onwards, but it was in sort of 2005 where everyone who was guilty of a major crime got their animal. And of course, you don't only get put in prison, but in China, they just executed the animaled people. In the USA, people get studied because they get these little magical powers as well, and people trying to work out what's going on there, so they get sort of like scientifically studied. But down in South Africa, where this book is set, in Johannesburg, so South Africa has one of the most progressive and liberal constitutions in the world, so because, of course, all the apartheid thing there, and now everyone's equal, and everyone's equal, and everyone's equal, except if you've got an animal. And like theoretically, like constitutionally, and as a law, you're equal. But once you get out of jail, once you've paid your price of being in jail and you get out, of course you are suddenly the new undercast in society. And so what happens is, in Johannesburg, all of the animaled people start living in this one sort of slum area, this abandoned apartment building, and they kind of take it over, and they start up the step, you know, they set up their own little community there where they can look out for each other. But of course, there, a lot of them are criminals, so the criminal world still exists, and they're having to sort of work their way through that kind of situation. So I really enjoy that the story is set in South Africa for the reasons of, you know, sort of like racism, and you know, that the kind of all that kind of human rights abuses and racism kind of thing is sort of like lingering there in the background. But of course, they you need this strong constitution to protect the main characters as they go around their business. To set this same kind of story in Europe or somewhere else, it might not have worked quite so well. Not quite sure, but it's an interesting setting. And of course, I think Lauren Bucus is South African as well, so it makes a lot of sense. But to get onto the sort of like the specific part of the setting, that it's set in Johannesburg itself, like I say, I did time my reading of this novel to when I visited the city, and it's actually a really good fun thing to do this. I'd never been to Johannesburg before. I've been to Cape Town before, but not to Johannesburg. And so when we were driving in, the taxi driver who was taking us from the airport to the hostel that we're staying in was saying, oh, and over here is this thing, and this thing's over here, and this thing's over here, and you can do this and this, and you want to go down to Soweto and all that kind of stuff. And I said, hey, where's Hillbrow? And because that's where a lot of the action is set in this book. And he said, oh, okay, there's the Hillbrow Tower over there, and that building next to it used to be the Coca-Cola Tower, and now it's this Vodafone Tower. It's this big round tower. And I was thinking, oh, that's interesting, because all of the book is sort of set around the area, but that other tower, one of the towers is mentioned, but the other tower near Hillbrow isn't mentioned. I was like, oh, well, it hasn't been mentioned. And we were driving past all these sort of these gold mine slag heaps, so all of the stuff that they dug out of the gold mines down there in Johannesburg, which wasn't gold, they sort of piled them up into these big slag heaps. And I was thinking, oh, they've not been mentioned in the book yet. And of course, I was only sort of like 2/3 of the way through the book, and by the end of the book, both of these extra things had been mentioned, the sort of the gold mine slag heaps and also this this rounded tower, and it's sort of they both of them become parts of the novel. And it's very strange to be like introduced to a city in a book and then turn up in that city while you're still reading the book, and then the different parts of the city that you've seen and wondered why they're not being included in the book are then included in the book. So it was a lot of fun to do this. So if you ever get a chance to actually read about a city while you're in the city, because you can sort of like have the questions about the city, which are then answered in the book, but also questions of the book, which are then kind of answered in the city itself. So that was a lot of fun, and probably contributed quite a lot to my enjoyment of this novel. So, getting onto the story, the plot. Zinzi is our main character. She was once a journalist, but then she got caught up in taking drugs, and somehow, again, I don't want to give too much away, but somehow was involved in the killing of her brother. And I guess there's no spoilers there, because we find out about that quite early on in the book. But she went to jail, and then she gets out of jail, and she has a sloth. Even when she was in jail, she had a sloth. But now she has a sloth, which is always this kind of millstone, or this sloth, hanging around her neck. And so, of course, this book is about the guilt with that, and dealing with your kind of dark past, your dark history. Her talent that she gets given by the magical universe is finding things. She can see connections between the person, these kind of wispy string-like connections between the person who has lost something and the thing that they have lost. Of course, it's very difficult for her, because most people have lost at least something, and she can see what they've lost. She can sort of picture it in her mind. And but it's really stressful for her to be with other people because she's constantly seeing things that people have lost. They've lost a pair of scissors or a ring or a gun or a photograph and all these different kind of things. And so one of her jobs is that she has to she puts up these little adverts around places and in classified adverts and on the internet saying, hey, have you lost something? I can find it for you. I can help you find it. So that's what she does. And also she's involved in the local kind of crime scene, drug scene. She helps out these crime lords, crime syndicates with their 419 email scams, and she writes out, oh, look, we're in an orphanage and we need to get some money for our orphanage, all this kind of stuff. And then if there's a meeting and they need a female character to play a part in some meeting where they want to get some money off some American who's flown in with money to help out some charity case out of the goodwill of their heart, she plays parts in those meetings as well. So she isn't all good. She's doing all the kinds of stuff there. She's got lots of jobs and lots of roles, but of course one job comes up and she gets this job offer from some dodgy characters, and of course she doesn't want to take the job, but she gets deeper and deeper into debt with the with her drug debts that she's had from before she went to jail. She takes on this job, and the job is working for a popular music producer called Odie Huron, I think his name was, and he's got two kids which are a bit, you know, your latest teeny popper kind of kids, don't know what the word is, some kind of, for me, of course, Britney Spears is the kind of thing that I have in my head when I think of young stars, but she's not even close to being a young star. But Justin Bieber is too much of an established star to what these kids are. They're rising stars. They haven't even got an album out yet, or they're just working on their first album. They've got like one hit song. And suddenly one of these two kids, it's a boy and girl, brother, sister kind of team. One of them, I think her name was Songwei, she goes missing. And Odie is like, hey, we need to find this girl. You can find missing things, find this girl. And Zinzi is like, I don't like finding people. I like finding objects. People are too complicated. But of course she needs the money, so she tries to find this girl. Now, I thought it would be quite simple for her because she just needs to find something that Songwei has lost, and then she can follow back that thread to the missing person. So she needs to find something she missed, but of course she can't find anything like that. And so quite quickly the story kind of leaves. I thought it would be a bit more magical about her magical ability, but that's kind of left behind. That's just a way into this story, and it quite quickly becomes a very typical noirish private eye tracking down a missing person story. But I actually quite like it that the magic at this point is kind of subsumed into the background, even though she always has a sloth and she's always got this kind of stuff going on. But she was once a journalist, so she starts using her journalistic talents, and she's connected to the sort of crime scene, so she starts using those things. It's not just, oh, I have this magical power, I'll rely on this magical power and I'll just go for it. It becomes very kind of real life system as well. I say system, what I'm trying to say, she systematically goes through different options and checks here and checks there and checks up with acquaintances, and it does, like you say, become quite noirish. But then of course, because it is this same kind of noir thing, there's going to be a wider conspiracy there, and you think, well, this character's a bit dodgy, and this, you know, this person, of course they're going to be involved somehow, and of course lots of them are. And then, at around about three quarters of the way through, the missing person story starts wrapping up, and I was wondering, hey, what else is going to happen here? And there was one twist, which I'd already kind of guessed, like why the music producer Odie Huron is a recluse and he never leaves his home. That's telegraphed way, way in advance why that is. And I was thinking, okay, well, that's interesting. And I kind of guessed what's going on there. I was thinking, but what else is there that we can find out? And suddenly the scenes at the end suddenly, like almost out of nowhere, become like massively, in some ways, unbelievable, but suddenly the magic elements come back in a big way, in a way that all the way through the book I was going, oh, why don't we concentrate more on the magic? Why don't we concentrate? We don't really know very much about the zoo people. Why do people get animals? What happens if this? What happens if that? And suddenly at the end, loads of these elements come back in. It's way overblown. It's way violent, but again, I like it. It's not only that Lauren Bucus doesn't pull punches at the end, she actively punches you in the face harder, because you're thinking, oh, this is nice, you know, there's kids in the story, and there's music, and there's all this stuff going on, and there's lots of nice animals going around, and suddenly at the end you go, no, no, really, this, the world is fucked up, and this is a story about fucked up people trying to get over their fucked up past and not being able to escape from it. And then, of course, things come back in a bad way. So if you want the magic, maybe the middle part of the novel slows you down a bit, and then if you just want the detective story, maybe the end of the book will let you down, because it doesn't come out of nowhere, but it is a lot different than you might like. I liked both parts, but I think they probably could have been fitted together a tad better. But otherwise, it is a very well-plotted book. There's not any flabby bits. At some points, Zinzi is a little bit too involved, and at other points, she's a bit too passive. Again, I don't want to give away too much there, but I think the story is short enough that even the parts where she's a bit passive, you can just go straight through, and other parts, you know. But otherwise, it's very much a page-turner. Oh, I kept on coming back to this. And after listening to an atrocious audiobook The 100,000 Kingdoms by N.K. Jemisin. I can't remember who the audiobook narrator was there. Like, it took me, that was a struggle to get through that. This was a real joy to get through. Let's talk a bit more about the characters. I wrote down some stuff. Zinzi is, I think, pretty cool. Because I like reading a character that I really like. I mean, it's weird. I like reading a character that I like. But I like people who have done bad stuff in the past, and then I know they're going to do more bad stuff in the future, and they might be wanting to do better, but if they need to compromise anything, they will compromise, you know, their good behavior and their principles and all these other things just to get stuff done. And if they're a likable character who is doing bad things and not trying to be all high-minded about it at all the time, I really enjoy that. And Zinzi is pretty much all about compromise. You know, everything that she does, she's like, oh, I want to do better. Okay, I can't do better. I've got to do this. Oh, I want to do, okay, I can't do this. It's like everything that she compromises at gets her into more, not into more and more trouble. It's just the way she lives her life. Like all the different situations that she gets into, she's it's always going through her mind is like, oh, I've got to do the best thing. Oh no, probably shouldn't do the best thing. Probably shouldn't do the good thing. I should probably just do the thing that gets me through this to the other side. I always like the say, was it, run away today, live to fight another day. But then you go, okay, run away today, live to run away another day. That kind of compromise stuff I think is very interesting in a main character. But she gets stuff done, and that's what I really like about it. Even though she's compromising her principles all the time, she does get stuff done. Her boyfriend, I can't remember the name of the boyfriend. I think it was a French name. I think he's from from Uganda or Congo or something like that. I'll call him Marcel. Anyway, that's not his name. I can't remember his name. He's another animal person. His gift is that does he have a raccoon or something like that? I think it's a raccoon. Anyway, his gift is that his magical ability is that he dampens the magical abilities of other people who have animals and small animal abilities, which is why Zinzi can relax when she's around him. She probably could find a better guy, but all the time she'd be seeing the things that the guy has lost around him and floating around. Because I say it's difficult for her to be around people and intimate with people. So even her choice of her boyfriend is sort of like a compromise. It's like, oh yeah, I can deal with this guy. I don't need to worry too much about this. And then it turns out that he's married. Again, we find this out right at the beginning of the book. But he was separated from his wife while fleeing from something like the Lord's Resistance Army, that kind of situation. And he's a refugee in South Africa, and that kind of thing as well. It's just like, oh wow, even her boyfriend is married, and yet even when she finds out that her boyfriend is married, it's just like, yeah, but the sex is really good and it's really easy to hang about, so I'll just keep having sex with him until he goes off and goes back to his wife again. It's like, and so many characters, you think, well, why are you doing that? Why don't you be the good person about it? But you realize that she's a real strong human character. I mean, it's not that she's a strong person, but her characters are very strong because all of these different compromises. Her job, like I say, is working for the email scammers and helping people, helping drug dealers and things like that, because she just does what she needs to get by. Like I say, and this is, I found it very easy to connect to someone like this, not because I don't have any principles, but, you know, just the small things about, like, me being a vegetarian on the inside. On the outside, I'm not a vegetarian because I really, really like meat, and meat is really handy. I travel a lot. It's very difficult to get vegetarian stuff all over the world when you're traveling. Of course, I could do it, but it'd be too bad. But on the inside, I'm thinking, you know, if I had real convictions, I'd be a vegetarian. But I know that I just have to compromise about that, and I have to be a good person in other ways, as I can be. At least I try to be. But you know, nobody's perfect, and it's nice to have characters which are all like that. And what else is it? Of course, always trying to do the right thing. She does try and do the right thing at the end of the book, and does she succeed? Well, I don't want to give it away. Maybe she does. Maybe she doesn't. She succeeds in some ways in throughout the story. In other ways, she fails quite badly. And I really like the not the ambiguity of this thing, but kind of like the real life connection, because it is a story about. I mean, that's one of the main themes of this. It's like a story about someone who is recognizable in society for having done bad things and how they have to get over it. Of course, I'll talk more about that later on. The other characters in the novel are also fun to spend time with and pretty well join. The teenage pop stars that we hang out with, in some ways the total opposite of Zinzi, in terms of their backgrounds, in terms of their lifestyle and things like that. But, you know, connecting to them through Zinzi is a lot of fun, and you do feel real compassion for the people who get into bad situations, because quite a lot of people get into quite a lot of bad situations in this book. And then, of course, there's the animals as well. There's Sloth. Sloth is awesome. He's sort of like always hanging around in the background as a companion, a familiar there. He's got this empathetic connection with Zinzi. And yeah, it's always fun that he's just like a little side character, but he really does bring it to life that Zinzi will be in a situation and she'll be thinking one thing, and then the sloth is like hitting on the side of the face going, no, don't do that, don't do that, oh, this guy, don't hang out with this guy, get away from this guy. And Sloth is always there as the monkey on her back, or the sloth on her back, tapping her on the side of the head going, oi, 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 that. And also, of course, there's a connection where if the sloth dies, or if any animal dies, you die as well, which makes for very, very tense action sequences when any kind of scrape or anything that can happen, you've got a quite fragile animal just hanging around with you. And all you need is to be separated from the animal, and you're going to be in a world of pain. And then if your animal dies, you'll actually be sucked out of the world in the undertow. Which, I guess I might as well bring me to the magic section of this review, where I talk about, normally in science fiction, I talk about the science and technology, but of course it's a fantasy book, so I'll talk about the magic. Now, good thing about this book is that there's always, if there's magic in a world, especially in the modern world, you can, if we're not in a secondary world, we're talking about Earth with countries that we know and recognizable features of society. You can have like these two different setups. Obviously, there's the one where everything is normal, but then underground, there's this secret group who use magic, and magic isn't known to the wider world, but magic does exist somewhere in the background. And the other kind of setup is that we're in the modern world, but magic exists, and then everyone knows that magic exists, but somehow the modern world is exactly the same as it is, like, the modern world in the book is exactly the same as it is in the real world, but yet magic exists. And I never understand how this can happen. I have to sort of, like, suspend my disbelief in a way at this point in the book, just to think that, a world can exist with magic and be anything like ours at all. Because if magic is known, everything would be different. And if it wasn't known, but it was known by a few people and actually exist, still, I reckon everything would be totally different. And that's kind of like a level of unbelievability, or a level of, sort of like one level of suspending disbelief that I have to do just to get into and enjoy the book itself. Now, what's very, very clever about this book is that I don't have to do that level of suspension of disbelief to enjoy the book there. Because in this world, magic is known, but it's only been known for sure for around about 5 or 6 years. And the magic just didn't exist in the world up until, like, the year 2000. And then after the year 2000, it starts existing. So everything in the world is there. Everything that we know in this world is there in the book. You know, the internet exists, there's email scams, people chat on Facebook and people chat on Skype, and the governments are the same, and the constitutions are the same, and everything is the same, except suddenly magic has come into the place. And, you know, the effects of this zoo plague are kind of just creeping in. I mean, the results, well, let me put it this way, on the surface, the plague is already there in force, but how it affects, how these animal people affect society is only just kind of creeping in. It's a new thing. People are, you know, still sort of discussing and going, what's going on? How does it all work? It's a mystery, not just to me as a reader, but it's a mystery to everybody, even the characters in the novel. And that's a refreshing change. Like I say, I just started reading this Brandon Sanderson novel, and it's like, oh, this is chapter one. So first of all, I'll explain all of the different elements of magic, and I'll talk about this magic, and I'll talk about that magic, and everyone in the book knows exactly how all of the magic works. It's all well-defined, everything's set up, and then once we have that, we'll go about the story. Even though in the book, the level of technology is super low, and scientific, you know, principles aren't known or anything like that, but somehow the magic is perfectly known and perfectly outlined in detail, explained in the first half of the book. But even in the real world, in our world, humans got on fine for centuries and centuries and centuries, not only not knowing how gravity worked, but sort of not even understanding how gravity even exists. They don't even understand there was a thing called gravity, but they were using it and just going about it. And so that the magic exists in sort of like a pre-technical and pre-scientific world. Sometimes it's a bit strange that everybody knows all of the secrets about it, even though they don't know what electricity is. But yet it's understandable that they don't try and explain it. It's just a force of nature. And what I'm trying to say is that if you're in another world and there's magic, I don't have to suspend my disbelief that magic exists. But it has to be well explained for me to understand the rules of it. Whereas in Zoo City, I don't have to suspend disbelief that magic exists in this world. And so that I don't understand it, and that even the characters don't understand it, and that it's not very well explained, I've got an extra bit of disbelief to suspend. I've got an extra quota of disbelief to suspend while reading the book, and I can suspend that disbelief in that this can just happen at all, and people just don't know about it, and everyone's still trying to get their head around what is happening. And I really liked that, you know, if it was sort of like in a secondary world, plus nobody knew how the magic worked, nobody at all knew how the magic worked, and it was all a mystery, I don't think I'd like to take those two steps. And it's nice that I only have to take this one big step in this novel, in the same way that there's one big step in most other kind of secondary world fantasy novels, but it's a different first big step. So maybe that was a little bit confusing, but I think it's an important aspect of this novel that if all this magic was well known, I wouldn't be able to believe it being set in this world, in this real world that we're living in now. I mean, if it's well known for a long time, but because it's all new, it makes it interesting. So what are we up to now in this writing? Yes, the writing style is very interesting. It's very noirish, of course. First person, it's present tense. I at least think it's present tense. I'm thinking back for quite a few weeks now since I read this book. And it's very, very well written. Some of the action is a little bit messy, but it was fun. And there is, like I say, there's different levels of tension there as well. It's not just, oh, are they going? Is this person going to get through without dying or not? Again, it's always given that extra little thing. It could be maybe their animal is going to get injured in some way. They might get through fine, but their animal's leg might be broken or chopped off or doing different things like that. There's all these different weird elements with the that people are interested in in these animals as prizes or different things like that. I don't want to go into too much because that is more spoiler territory, but there's quite a lot of other stuff going on with the animals. But yeah, lots of really funny passages as well. There's, of course, you get all these kind of noirish metaphors. It was this and this, and her cigarette looked like a thingy thing. I can't come up with them off the top of my head. But Zinzi, who is writing this, well, not Zinzi, but Lauren Bucus, has loads of really good, interesting noir-style metaphors taken from the life of Zinzi, who is, you know, an animal journalist, ex-journalist criminal living in a kind of a slum in South Africa. But also, she's just a female as well. So you get all these different metaphors which come from her life as just growing up. There's one that stuck out in my stuck in my mind like a bit of pubic hair stuck in my mouth or something like that. No, was it? Something nagged at me like a bit of pubic hair stuck in your mouth after all. So, you know, it's that kind of thing. We've all been there. In fact, my first ever time. No, I won't tell that story. But you know, all of this, all of these different things, is actually really, really, really good fun. Very well written. Loads of really good turns of phrase, which made me laugh all the way through. Another thing I want to bring out about the writing style is that these different sections, which are written as emails or like the script from a TV documentary or a newspaper or magazine article or a page for a movie on IMDb or Wikipedia pages, and I really enjoy the insertions of these little sections into the story. It's a great way to info dump a lot of information about the world, because everything is done in first person from Zinz's point of view. So when you want to find out about, oh, well, let me, what about a bit more about these animaled people? What about this zoo plague? And so you go, oh, okay, we'll go over here and we'll have a newspaper article about this. Or let's learn about this movie, this documentary, which follows different people around the world. Oh, here's a Wikipedia page about this. And it's a good way, like I say, to info dump without making the story run really, really long. And also without kind of breaking that first person perspective. And also, it's just a good way to break up the script. If it was all like Zinzi going, okay, and I did this and this, this, and then I went to bed, and then I got up and did this, you're like, okay, well, when you go to bed, and then we can cut away, and we can have this script from a TV show, and then we can cut back again, and then the story can continue. So it's a nice way to break up the story and info dump all at the same time. The only time this doesn't work is because I'm reading it, I was listening to it as an audiobook, and when two people chat to each other you're reading the script of a chat log, or let me put it this way, two people chatting on the internet. I think that this is the case when you're reading a script, you don't have to put all the attribution in. It was sort of like, Nwongo guy 576, blah, 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 blah. H Garth 9212Z says this. And then those two names are just repeated over and over again. So you're getting the names and the numbers at the beginning of everything that they say, and so often the names and the numbers which are included like in the names in the chat window take up way too much of the time when you're actually listening to it. And even if they say a one word answer, the attribution can be longer than the one word answer. And I think in that case what they should do with audiobooks is just cut that down, and cut out some of those attributions and just go with the flow of it. Let the actor or actress, the voice actor, just do what they can to distinguish between the two voices and just read the script out, or just change the names at that point. You can probably get away with just changing the names and just going through it with much, much shorter attribution rather than these long text names, which, like you read on the screen, you just scan over it. But with an audiobook, they sort of like punched into your face at every moment. What's here? Oh yeah, the reading. I really enjoyed the audiobook narration. I think it's Justine Airy, or Air. I can't remember how to pronounce the name, but I just made a note of it here. She was really, really good. As I was listening to this, I was traveling through Africa, so I was getting a good taste of the different accents and different through the different nationalities and different cultures and things like that. And the audiobook narrator, Justine Airy, did really, really well with a lot of these. It was a lot of fun. Every character had a very distinctive voice, and the accents were all spot on. As far as I can tell, I'm not an expert at accents, but it was good fun to listen to this, to the audiobook while I was actually traveling through South Africa. Which brings me to the last little bit of this review, which I normally talk about the themes here. And this is, I think, a great one. Of course, there's a lot about personal identity and guilt and carrying around the thing that you're guilty about, the sign of your guilt and things like that. But one thing I really enjoy about this is kind of the treatment of these people of a different race, even though they're not of a different race. And this is the question, is like, is racism really racism if the distinguishing mark of your difference between two people is something that one of them chose to do? So, for example, everyone has an animal, but they only have an animal if they're guilty about something. And so it begins, and there's this really, really fun passage about when we learn about the Afghan warlord who has a penguin in a flak jacket. And he was one of the first documented cases of one of the zooed people, animaled people from the zoo plague. And they're like, why is this Afghan warlord got a penguin in a flak jacket? And of course, he was showing off his penguin. Is like, hey, this is my awesome thing. I've got a penguin. And once people worked out what it was like a real source of pride for him. It's like, because he's an Afghan warlord and he's wearing his symbol of differenceness. He's wearing a symbol of guilt as a badge. But then others hide their animal. When they have an animal, they hide it in every way. Some people are really lucky that their animal is really small. We learn about one guy with a butterfly, and he just puts it in a matchbox and puts his butterfly in his pocket, and then he can walk around, and nobody cares that he is an animaled person, because they don't see he's an animaled person. And then there's other people who don't have animals, but pretend to have animals to make them seem cooler. You know, you get these... I think it's mentioned, mild spoiler here, some of the pop stars that they go, hey, we're a band, and all of the members of this band have got an animal. And there's this one guy, turns out his animal isn't a magic familiar animal. It's just an animal. And then you get these sections where you learn about the people in prison, and it's some of the people, it doesn't matter what crime you've committed, if you've got a cool animal, you're on top in the prison, because you've got a cool animal. And if your animal is rubbish, like if you've got a kitten, well, no, I guess a kitten grows up into a cat. But if you've got a small, useless animal like a mouse, and someone else has got a tiger, it doesn't matter what crime you've committed, you're out on top. So suddenly there's different layers of acceptance or different layers of status within the people who have animals. And there's another character who's this refugee princess, and she's all, she's all like, oh no, I need to get back, I'm all in danger. So she looks really innocent, and then it's exposed that she also has an animal, but the people who are there to help her, these charity people who are there to help her, they suddenly feel sorry for her. It's like, oh, you poor girl, no, don't tell us what you did or why you had to do it. We understand that you've been through a bad time. We're going to help you out. We're going to help you in this situation. Don't worry about that. And it becomes a sign that she was obviously someone in a bad situation, and then she was a victim in that situation, and that she had to do what she did, and she's feeling guilty about it, but obviously there's sort of like that, those things where she was going to get raped, or, you know, in the mind of the people looking at her, she's this powerless young girl, and they're like, oh, you can't be really bad, even if you've got this animal, you can't be really bad, so we'll pretend that you've not been really bad in our minds, we'll pretend that you had to, you weren't guilty of this crime, just say that these people were going to be, they were going to rape you, and you had to do all you can to stop them raping you. Yeah, I'll project that onto you, because that's the only way that I can think that you could have an animal. It couldn't be anything that you chose to do. And in some cases, I guess that's right. What are the other notes that I have here? Oh, yeah, there's a bar, and the dancing girls in this sort of, like, sexy bar, they all have animals. But the waitresses, they can't have animals, because they get too close to the customers, to the patrons and stuff like that. So this whole thing, this whole novel is quite... there's quite a lot of ambiguity in this as well. If you pick up a sign of differenceness because you chose to do it, are people's prejudice against you... or are the prejudices against you acceptable? And sometimes Zinzi uses this to her advantage. Sometimes she wears the sloth out in the open as though, like, hey, I'm a badass. And other times she hides it under a hoodie, or hides the sloth in a bag or something like that. So yeah, it's a bit strange. And this always comes back to, like, the idea of, like, okay, if you're choosing to do something, can we discriminate against you or something you chose to do? And then, of course, it brings back to the kind of thing, if you're in a life of crime, did you choose to be in that life of crime? I mean, did you choose to commit that crime in the first place? Or is it just just something that you know, it was your upbringing and all that kind of stuff? So, I mean, it's a very interesting book. It brings up lots of these different things. Some of these points are addressed quite head-on. Others are kind of addressed obliquely. But I really enjoyed this, and the kind of things that it starts making you think about. Of course, for me, it brings into all this different stuff about guilt and crime and doing bad things, but also then about being good things. If you choose to do something good and people reward you for doing something good, is that a good thing? Yes, I guess. But I guess a lot of people do good things not out of choice, again, just because they only have an illusion of free will. I guess it's the same kind of thing about religion. Is discriminating against people on behalf of their religion, is that racism? Well, I don't think it is racism, because I think if you're born with it, but then I do think it is racism because a lot of people don't choose their religion. Like, I only chose my religion after I'd been a hardcore Christian all my life. And I didn't choose that. You know, I was brought up in a Christian home. I only had one kind of form of education in terms of religious matters, and that I had no choice about that. So up until the point where I actually thought stuff out for myself, say up until I was 20 years old or something, if you were discriminating against me because I was a Christian, that would have been some form of racism. But then after that, if I'd have made up my mind and stayed Christian, and then you discriminate against me, well, is that racism? Anyway, so there's all of these different kind of ideas that this book brings up, which, again, you could bring these things up if it wasn't set, if the book wasn't set in South Africa. But I think that it is set in South Africa really brings out some of these things, but it doesn't bash you over the head with it. It's not like, bum, 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 this is about black people living in slums, this is about race, this is about Soweto and the uprising there, this is about this and this. It's nothing to do with that. It's way, way more subtle than that. And because it is set in South Africa, I think they can bring out these different ideas and themes, but without it being bashing you over the head with it. Whereas I think if this was the same novel was set in Los Angeles or New York or somewhere else that you would normally set a kind of urban fantasy, I think it would have been less subtle in a way, because the ambiguity of the South African constitution and the history of racism there really does bring things out. You know, it's probably not a coincidence. Well, again, I don't know the full history here, but there's the whole... No, actually, I'm not even going to get into the race riots and the uprising in South Africa, because I do think it's best to leave that kind of stuff in the background of this novel rather than bring it out explicitly. It's good to think about it. Yep, I think that's all I'm going to say about this book. I'm going to give it 4 stars. It might have been worth more than that, because, well, there's lots of great stuff about this book. I really enjoyed the narration. I really enjoyed reading the book while travelling through Southern Africa and while sort of like visiting the places or seeing the places where this story is set while I was listening to it. That was a lot of fun. The story is really good, but it is a little bit disjointed in some places. It doesn't all connect together perfectly. I really enjoyed the characters and the magic and everything like that, but I understand if some people don't enjoy it too much because, like I say, the disjointedness means that you've got to kind of like all the elements of it to really enjoy it. Like I mentioned before, if you're not really into the interesting exploration of these different magical ideas and the magical world, and you just want a good detective novel, the end of the book will probably be really off-putting for you, because there aren't any punches pulled in any way here at all. So, it depends what you're into, but I'm going to give it 4 stars. I think it's really worth reading. I do recommend it. That's it for that. And what else? Yes, you can email me, luke@juggler.net. I do reply to every email. I finally caught up with all of the listener email. That's really great as well. Some people have emailing me saying, hey, I read Mining Tomorrow and I've just read Combat, or I've read Get That Rat Off My Face, and I'm going to read your other books. I do say don't read Combat, because at the moment I am just about to start re-editing Combat again, and I'm going to put up a new ebook version of that now that I've finished writing and editing all the way through to the end of the trilogy, Mining Tomorrow and Combat and Broken Glass. Don't bother reading Combat yet, because I'm doing a final edit of that before I put out Broken Glass, so you can read, I think, a much better version of that. It'd be Combat 4.0, version 4.0. Don't read 3.0, read 4.0 if you're listening to this in the future and you're not quite sure what to read. So watch out for that. You can find that at lukeburridge.com/fiction. My blog, I'm updating my blog now with photos and things of my trip through Africa. So if you want to see lots of wildlife photos, you can go to lukeburridge.com/blog. And that's it. Or goodreads.com. Send me messages there. Follow me there and send me book recommendations there, or by email as well. So you can find me on, and also there's a listeners group on goodreads.com where you can go and post messages there. There's always other sfbrp.com podcast listeners who will reply to you, and you can discuss books there among yourselves if you want to get feedback from other listeners rather than from me via email. That's it for now. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.